Hello, and welcome to The Spark. I'm Matt, and by the grace of the Nashville Public Library, I'm here to talk about the creative process and the joy of appreciating the creations of others. But this episode is going to sound a little different. I had an excellent conversation with my guest for today's show, but sadly, due to some technical glitches, we don't have my side of that conversation. Thankfully, this episode was recorded remotely, so we do have my guest's audio. I'll be chiming in to introduce topics and add context, while you can hear her insights just like I did. Just assume that anytime Jenna says something thoughtful or funny, which is basically the whole piece, I reacted accordingly in the moment. And with that, my guest today holds a master's degree in media and culture, which she uses to enlighten the internet via videos and podcasts, with a particular focus on video games and the horror genre. It's Jenna Stieber.
Hello! Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
And before anything else, I wanted to know what achieving a master's in media and culture looks like.
I actually have a terminal master's, so I did comps tests, which basically when it came down after my 2 years of study, I did a series of tests to prove that I could memorize quotes from way smarter people than me. So a lot of like Marshall McLuhan quotes that I just lodged in my brain and then were able to pull up as needed, which has proven very useful. I didn't do a proper thesis because I didn't complete my PhD studies, but it would have been on the ways in which sound technology evolved alongside the survival horror genre, because the survival horror genre relies very much on being able to place enemies in a three-dimensional audio landscape. And that was only thing that video games could do once audio became complicated enough to allow for a 3D landscape. So I just did a lot of research on that, and it was an area of interest that I would have loved to have dug into even more.
But of course, this episode having been recorded in December, I had to broach the topic of choosing a game of the year.
Oh my God, so much. Yeah. And in a way, I love Game of the Year stuff because it's fun to sort of look back at the year and think about all of the incredible games I played. This was a truly stellar year for just high quality, really engaging games. And then comes the miserable task of ranking those games in any sort of semblance of a list.
And on that miserable task, I was particularly curious how, in a medium as varied in style and experience as video games, Jenna goes about comparing games that succeed or excel at what they're trying to do in such different ways.
Oh, Matt, that's a great question. That is like a really great question. It's extremely hard, is what I'll say. And I've had to reflect on it a lot more this year than I have in previous years, because in the last couple of years, there has been pretty much like a game or two games that I'm like, wow, this is clearly my number one and number two. I just have to figure out which order they're in or something like that. And this year has been really difficult because there genuinely hasn't been, there have been so many standout games, but there hasn't been a clear number one for me. And that is just really difficult. Normally how my list ends up shaking out, and this is not something I was really cognizant of, but which I've had to think about this year, is that normally 10 through 7 on a top 10 game of the year list, 10 through 7 are games that were really, really incredible gameplay, but maybe not that interesting art or a story, but not like a really impactful story or, you know, not the whole package. And then 7 to 3 or 2 are usually games that were like really just firing on all cylinders. Great art, great story, great characters, great music, great gameplay, a good runtime, a runtime appropriate to the material it had to offer, I should say. And then 1 and 2 are games that like fundamentally challenge my concept of what games are or could be in some way. So last year it was, I think Indica was my game of the year. And Indica is such a thoughtful game about video games in a way that does not call attention to the fact that it's about video games. And there just hasn't been an Indica this year. And Indica is in its way because it is just so overt with the game elements in a way that is so disruptive to the vibe of the game, which does make it feel fourth wall breaking in a way, even though it really isn't. And then you have other games. Generally, games in my one or two are games that are playing with the pure structure of what video games are and what they can be. So I think the year before it was Mouthwashing, which is another game that I have done a video on recently. And both of those games are tangling with the structure of video games in a way that precludes them being any other medium. So, like, you could never, you couldn't have, there would be no point to make Indica as a TV show. Sorry, Last of Us. There's no reason to make Mouthwashing a movie because they are so essentially at their core, they have to be games. And there have been so many incredible games this year. Clair Obscur, so good. So good. Pipistrello, there's so many incredible games this year, but none of them have been, like, challenging what the medium of games can be. But is that a fair, Matt, you tell me, is that a fair way of marking a good game? Like, is that too high a standard to place on a game of the year?
For my money, I thought that rewarding media that's innovative and successful in that way is a very valid rubric for criticism. But as Jenna said, that was a pattern in her games of the year that she's noticed from years where she found that happened, which led me to wonder, if this wasn't one of those years for her, whether 2025 was a year less of groundbreaking ideas and more of games that excel in realms we've seen before.
Yeah, I think that would be a fair way of describing it. But I'm also like, does that mean I'm not going to have a game of the year? That's boring. Is it just going to be Clair Obscur? Because that's also boring, because Clair Obscur just absolutely cleaned up at the Game Awards and everybody loves it. Right? It's sort of like head cheerleader becoming homecoming queen. It's like, what are we even doing?
Thinking of 2025 games that weren't groundbreaking but were excellent led me to mention the games that I spent the most time with last year, Hades 2 and Hollow Knight Silksong. You know, the sequels to beloved games but now you play as their cool sister who can sprint duology.
Yes, that is so such a funny through line to me. The 1-2 punch of those games both being like, yeah, here's the faster girl version of that first game. It's like, thanks, kind of.
This led to what is, to me, a big question in comparing pieces of media. How do you value something that's well-executed but not offering anything new versus something that does have new ideas but may come up short on some fundamentals?
Let me counter that with a question. Are you asking about Blueprints? Because what I thought of is Blueprints. It's a game that came out in sort of the early doldrums of the year. The way that game releases happen now are basically January through March is absolutely direft of games. Like, there's just no games get released, so any game that does come out that is decent gets a lot of gameplay, and I think that's sort of Blueprints. But it's a roguelike puzzle game, which is conceptually very interesting. They are definitely doing something new and unique with those elements. But spoilers, it's not going to be on my game of the year list. And that's because I think, although it is doing something new and interesting with those genres, it was too ambitious and it badly needed to be edited down from what it was. And so I played like a lot of that. I played probably like 30 or 40 hours of the game. And I enjoyed a decent amount of my time with it, but which I don't fundamentally think it was well-designed enough to be on my Game of the Year list.
And that makes sense. It put me in mind of a metric touted by Justin McElroy. Does this game respect my time?
Yes. And one thing I've become very conscious of this year is that refrain, but also the fact that that refrain is coming from me and other people who engage with games for a living and who have to engage with a lot of games for their living. And it's like, I can't fault somebody who wants to spend all of their gaming time in a year playing 200 hours of Clair Obscur or Night Rain or whatever. But by the nature of the work that I do, I have to have a game that is respectful of my time. And I just don't think Blueprints was that. I don't think Silksong was that either.
And quite a few people were frustrated with Silksong in particular in 2025. Usually with its difficulty, but in some ways that's the same complaint if you're being asked to spend your time and energy learning difficult bosses or platforming challenges. But there were also folks like me who really liked sinking time into only a couple games last year. For me, again, Silksong and Hades 2. And particularly those two games offering so much playtime at reasonable price points was, pardon the pun, a boon for many a gamer.
Yes, and yeah, I think that's a great point, is like, inherently, my values in video games are different from the values of somebody who is not a professional video gamer, because it's like my job. It is like my job. So I've got to put in the hours. I've got to play a lot of games. Sometimes I pay for those games out of my own pocket, but I do that knowing that it's a tax write-off. And a lot of them I get for free. And so, like, fundamentally, the cost is less important.
But what about before video essays and GOTY lists? I asked Jenna about her gaming history, how those formative games informed her tastes now, and what recent games have hit similar marks.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I growing up, we had a Game Boy. And by we, I mean my sister had a Game Boy. And I really only got it after she grew tired of it and grew bored of the games she had. But we had, like, all of the classics. We had Super Mario. We had one of the Final Fantasies. We had Kirby's Dream Land. We had Link's Awakening, just remains, I think, a top-tier game, one of my favorite games. But yeah, these games very much informed the things that I think of as being, like, good parts of games, which is, first of all, they're pretty short. They're reasonably short. They have to be, because they got to fit on those little game cartridges. But they're also, like, so much more about kind of exploration and just, like, walking around and seeing what you find and, ooh, discovering little secrets and little tricks and stuff. So I do find myself still finding those elements very appealing. But I think most gamers do. One of my Game of the Years this year is going to be Pipistrello and the Cursed Yo-Yo. And it is very much styled as like a Game Boy Advanced game. So the lineage is extremely clearly there, but it is also like, I think with retro games, you really have to balance the retro elements that you're bringing in without bringing in some of the downsides of those retro elements. And I think Pipistrello does such an incredible job where it has a core concept, which is you've got a magical yo-yo that is possessed by your aunt's spirit, and you do combat, you do movement, you do all sorts of tricks and puzzles and stuff with that. But they iterate so complexly on what that simple little yo-yo does, that, and the whole world is so expansive that you really want to get out there and explore, and then you are rewarded so well for exploring. And it's really that kind of gameplay loop that I loved growing up and I still love. And that is something that I think is very iconic. I was speaking to somebody on a different podcast about this recently, about Portal and the ways in which Portal really created the blueprint for modern indie games, which is very much like, we have one idea. You can shoot portals. You can shoot them on these walls only. Here's the real strict rules that we have set up for this world. And now we're just going to iterate in every possible way on this one little core concept. And to me, it feels a lot of times that the split between like AAA games and indie games is that concept. Because AAA games are very much like, we're going to take every single game mechanic and do it to a certain extent and make it available. And it's going to be a certain amount of depth depending on the game. You know, crafting might be really intense, or it might be just like another little layer of things that you can do to spend your time in this world. But then indie games are going the opposite way, which is like, there's going to be like one mechanic, but we're going to do everything with that mechanic and we're going to bring it to its absolute limits.
AAA games, the biggest, most expensive games made by the biggest, most expensive studios, your Gods of War, your Assassin's Creeds, etc., are often notorious for this smorgasbord approach to game mechanics. I've often heard it noted that you can feel how long a big game has been in development for all the mechanics that were new and shiny throughout that time that it picked up along the way. Jenna posited a sort of trickle-up effect of game mechanics and wondered what would happen when that foundation isn't there.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's absolutely accurate. And sometimes they're quite half-baked when that happens because the muffins weren't ready yet. And so, but they still get put in the game. But this is sort of the cycle of game development right now, where indie games will create really interesting little core concepts and then become mega huge, Stardew Valley. And then the things that Stardew Valley didn't make farming sims, but they reminded people that farming sims existed and were good and sold crazy well. So a bunch of these mainstream AAA games were like, oh, okay, I guess we've got to include that. PUBG comes out. It didn't make battle royales as a concept, but it did become the most popular version. And then bigger games and bigger studios took those ideas and iterated upon them. So this is sort of the cycle. And actually, this is one of the things that makes me most worried about video games right now, is that because funding is so hard to get for video games right now, a lot of indie games, the indie game studios that would be creating the next big mechanic that larger studios would rip off, are simply drying up and just not making games, or closing down, or those games get released but they don't get any big attention. And so it's just like, well, gosh, what are AAA studios going to rip off in the next 5 years? I don't know what it's going to do to games.
Talking about video game genres made me think of Jenna's own video on the subject, in which she encourages people to broaden their horizons and try genres they aren't familiar with or drawn to, because there's almost certainly something in there that they'll like. I wondered whether there were any genres, video game or otherwise, that she'd had difficulty getting into.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm still coming around on RPGs. And this is, again, this is a function of the work that I do, which is that I want to play as many indie games as possible. And so investing 100 hours in a French RPG is a difficult request for me. But if something is an exceptional example of its genre, it can make you better able to appreciate other parts of that genre. So I think this was the case with Hades. Is I know a lot of people who did not previously ever play roguelikes who got into Hades, not necessarily for the roguelike elements, but because of the storytelling and the bodacious art and all of the romances and conversations and relationships, and then came to appreciate what roguelikes could do because of that. Yeah, I don't know if you experienced this in Hades 2, but because I had played so much Hades 1, when I entered Hades 2, I was already like ready to go, just in terms of, like, obviously there's new boons and new powers and everything, but I felt, skill-wise, I felt very prepared. And I was having an issue where I was getting too far and not getting to hang out with people enough. And so that kind of incentivized me in a weird way to take boons I wouldn't normally take, because it's just like, well, I would actually love for this run to not go too long, because I want to go talk to Moros and see what the vibe is.
I felt similarly prepared going into Hades 2, and to me it felt like they expected that. There's so many of the mechanics from Hades 1 that are introduced very quickly in Hades 2 that it felt like they're expecting you to have come in with that experience so that new things can be built on top of it. I also felt similarly prepared for Silksong, but in particular I found it really interesting to see or feel how they made it harder compared to Hollow Knight, how often they did or didn't reuse tricks from the first game. Because I do think it's harder than Hollow Knight, but at least for me, it never felt like they were making Silksong more difficult by requiring you to have better and better reflexes or to hit harder and harder. In Silksong, they just keep putting you in these arenas where waves and waves of freaky little dudes come at you, and then one big freaky dude. It felt like what they were testing was your focus, how long you can maintain that.
I think each studio kind of has their own gameplay logic for how they approach their levels or character designs or combat or anything along those lines. And I think Silksong and Hades 2 are such an interesting, like, duo, because I think both of these games, as you say, like, they really anticipate that you're coming into the game with some concept of what they are doing. And I think it was smart on both of those games' parts, because not only did so many people play the original game, but they had such an impact on other games that they kind of rewrote both of their genres, essentially, in a ways that I feel like kept going so that even if you didn't play Hades 1, if you played other roguelikes, you probably entered Hades 2 with a good idea of what you're doing.
After chatting about video games for a while, I wanted to make sure we touched on Jenna's other main wheelhouse, horror. The state of the genre, its historical place in pop culture, and Jenna's personal history with it.
Oh, since I was very young, I have distinct memories of having a birthday slumber party and going to Blockbuster. Actually, I don't think it was a Blockbuster. I think it was the local family video, like, independent video store. And my mom, we were getting videos, and my mom was like, oh, you've got to get this one. And she picked up a black and white movie, and I was like, what even is this? And it was Night of the Living Dead, the original Night of the Living Dead. Which in hindsight, like, mom, that's crazy. Anyway, we got a bunch of slumber party videos and we didn't end up watching that one because I was like, it's a black and white movie. How is it even going to be scary? Like, what even are we doing here, mom? And then the next day watching it because we paid money to rent it and you didn't rent movies without watching them because that was a waste. So it was like 10 a.m. on a Saturday. I was watching Night of the Living Dead and it scared me. It was terrifying. It's a good movie. And that really altered my brain about, like, what movies can be and what horror can be and what is effective about it. And then after that, I just really went out of my way to watch any horror movies that was, like, on TV. And you really just had to roll your dice because of how TV functioned back in the day. But I was a big fan of it. I was super into slashers in high school. And then I sort of fell away from horror because it's not a cool, good genre. And if you like good things, you don't watch horror movies. And so in college, I just stopped watching horror movies, even though I really liked them. But then I read an incredible academic text called Men, Women, and Chainsaws by Carol Clover. This is the book that the concept of the final girl comes from. So that has entered, I think, mainstream media lexicon, but people don't probably because she's a woman in academia. Nobody ever points out that Carol Clover created that idea in this book. But it's an incredible book because it takes slasher movies like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and really treats them like high art and respects them in a way that we don't often do with horror or, by the way, with video games. And so that really opened my eyes to this sort of high culture, low culture dichotomy that exists and that prevents some things from being respected in the ways that they really ought to be. Carol Clover, by the way, is not a horror academic. She studies like Scandinavian culture. She wrote this one iconic seminal book on horror media and then has never written about it again. And I'm obsessed. I love her. But there's famously the movie Halloween, which I do believe now is considered a classic, even for people who don't love or watch horror movies. Like, I think people respect it as cinematic in a cinema. But it's very famously, like, Halloween came out and was considered schlock. It's considered garbage. It's considered just another slasher movie and all of these things. And then there was a review in the Village Voice in New York that approached it and was like, actually, there's quite a lot of, like, intertextual cinematic things happening here. There's a sequence in it that is actually a direct reference to Meet Me in St. Louis. There's a sequence in that that has sort of a jump scare sequence in that movie. And so this one review comes out about Halloween and just completely changes the cultural and critical perspective on Halloween and essentially made a career for everybody involved, Deborah Hill and Carpenter and like all of these people who got to have careers because people were willing to engage with this horror movie as though it were cinema, as though it were a respectable piece of cinema. And I think you can do that with all media. And I tried to do that again with video games. Like, there's a question of like, what is the game or movie or TV show trying to do? And is it successful in doing it? And those are two different questions. But you do have to consider both when you're approaching a piece of media. And for me, that means I'm much more interested in like very earnest pieces of media that are really trying something ambitious, even if they fall short. And I say that and I'm directly contradicting what I said earlier about blueprints. So I maybe there's something here in my critical perspective I need to readjust. But for movies, I think in general, I respect ambition more. Wherein in video games, because you have fewer restraints or different kinds of restraints, I have maybe higher standards for games than I do movies.
And how one interacts with something critically can and probably should differ from one kind of media to another. Like we talked about earlier, games tend to ask a lot more of your time than movies. They often involve more of your participation as well as your attention. But back on horror movies, Jana talked a little in her video on jump scares about the recent trend of prestige horror films. And it having been a bit since that video came out, I wondered how that landscape was looking now. And received Jenna's thoughts on what we can get from horror as a genre suited toward challenging us.
Oh boy, I think about making a follow-up to that, and I guess I'm going to have to. Every year I say to myself, I'm going to do a video that's just about prestige horror, and you know it hasn't happened yet, but I think 2026 is definitely the year it's going to happen. I think I don't care for prestige horror because it's demanding things of horror that I think are unfair and uninteresting. I think most prestige horror is trying to create horror in a way that does not challenge or discomfort the audience. And that is something that has been on my mind quite a lot because I do feel like America is essentially a culture of convenience and we just don't want to ever be challenged or made uncomfortable or made inconvenient, and we have, I think, very little patience for any of that. And in my mind, it's hard to detract a horror movie that refuses to scare you or make you uncomfortable from that kind of culture. And to me, it seems bad. It seems bad, Matt. I want to engage with media that challenges me and makes me uncomfortable because I want to have a moment where I'm like, oh, well, why did that make me uncomfortable? What does that mean? What does that mean about me or the culture I live in or my expectations or standards? And I think if you are never challenged on any of those parts, then you're not ever self-examining in an interesting way. And to me, horror has the capacity to do that almost fundamentally. And so prestige horror wanting to pull away from that, it just seems like, well, what's even the point then? Just make a thriller. Just make a thriller. It's an inherently challenging, and that doesn't always mean it's going to be good. And that doesn't mean you're always going to learn something about yourself or your culture. If you don't like spiders and you watch a movie with spiders and you get uncomfortable, it's like, oh, gosh, what is the, oh, what's the math here? It's like, no, that's very straightforward. But if you're watching something and it's challenging you, I mean, you listen, you spent a lot of this year playing Silksong, it sounds like. So obviously you're a little freak who loves difficult, challenging little experiences. And I think it's sort of a similar thing where it's like you have to be willing to challenge yourself because you're going to learn about yourself when you do that. And that can mean a lot of things. What it can mean to challenge yourself means a lot of stuff. And doing it in a safe place, like playing a video game or watching a movie, is going to better equip you to deal with those challenges out in your real life. And it's just, you know, do you feel like playing Silksong has changed how you approach anything else in your life? Or are you like, nah, I was already hardened by years of Hollow Knight?
It's true. I played a lot of the difficult bug game in the back quarter of 2025, and I loved it, but it is also quite difficult, and I don't blame anyone who found it too difficult to enjoy. In many ways, Silksong's defining trait went from being game that doesn't exist, put on your clown nose, gamers, to, oh, this is hard. And while I don't know that I'll have a sort of Slumdog Millionaire moment where something I accomplished in Silksong will have a direct corollary in my life, the ways in which this game is difficult, hordes of enemies that tax you and long platforming segments that frustrate you, gave me an opportunity to cultivate focus or harvest patience.
Harvesting patience is an incredibly accurate and funny way to describe genuinely any Souls-like game. But I think even if you are not like consciously reapplying those skills, I think even just exercising the part of your brain that does those sorts of things has benefit elsewhere, right? Like it's the same as like if you exercise in your day-to-day life, you will also feel the change that your body has because, you know, like, oh, you stretch better or your back doesn't hurt as much anymore because you did a little bit of exercise. I think that same is true for mental exercise as well. And so it can't always be identifiable, but if you watch a lot of horror movies, there's a chance that your brain will just be calmer because it's like, well, you know, but it's not a clown from space that turns into a giant spider. So, you know, I can handle this.
Having talked a lot about the kinds of media that she makes videos about, I wanted to touch on the videos themselves, starting with, how does a topic cross the threshold from just something that worms around her brain to a full video?
It's very intuitive. I'll say, I mean, like I've already mentioned it, that there are ideas for videos that I've been gnawing on for a while but haven't committed to. And sometimes it's just a matter of like, you know, this is what I'm really interested in right now. Sometimes I'll latch on to something and I'll be like, wow, this is a great idea for a video. And then I start to write it and I'm like, oh, there's nothing here. That is often the case. But if you do this long enough, you get a sense of like, okay, what is the headline for this? What is the opening paragraph for this? If I can't think of an interesting way to introduce this idea, it's probably not a full video. And that doesn't mean it won't become content in some way, especially with shorter videos possible on YouTube and TikTok now, although I don't really often mess with them. But I've got a lot of video ideas that I've written down in a doc somewhere on Google and never engaged with because writing it down was enough for me to stop thinking about it anymore. But it's normally there's just like a brain gnawing experience where it's like, oh, what examples could I use to support this? Oh, what do I think is actually happening here? You know, do I think people would actually be interested in that? It's a lot of questions and a lot of good video ideas fall because like I can't think of a good way to intro it. And that's just how it is.
Most of her videos we've talked about so far are on Jenna's own channel, but I first saw her work when she was with Polygon. I wondered what making videos on her own for her channel is like versus her time with Polygon, what that presumed freedom was like compared to more oversight, but also more assistance in a larger team.
It's quite a lot harder, and it's inevitably, because if you're working on a team, you have a team worth of ideas and a team worth of insight and a team worth of people writing jokes and honing ideas. And you can also bounce ideas off and be like, does this make sense? Does what I'm saying, can you literally just understand sentence to sentence what I am saying here? And not having any of that is a real shame. But I think of that process, the thing I miss the most is doing pitches, basically pitching ideas. Because oftentimes you'll have an idea that's like, oh, you know, I want to do a video about dogs and can I pet the dog in video games? And it's like, okay, that's a great concept, but what is the actual video about? It's not just 20 minutes of people petting dogs in video games. What do you actually want to say about this? What do you actually want to communicate? What are you trying to pull together? And that's, I try to do that with myself. I try to sit myself down and say, okay, so you have this idea. What is the actual length of this? Like, what is the actual headline? Because you have to think about that if you're making videos for YouTube. Like, what are people actually going to click on? And can you make, what is the nut, right? Like, what is the nut of this idea that people are going to gnaw down into and eat and be satiated by? And that is the thing I miss the most, because it's just harder to do that with yourself, because I think all my ideas are great.
These benefits of collaboration went beyond the writer's room as well, into the recording of the videos themselves.
Yes, that's obviously, because it is also a performance, right? Every video is a performance in some way. And that is a hurdle I see a lot of journalists fall down on, because the nature of TikTok is such that journalists have to basically read their own articles for TikTok. And I regret that they have to do that, because a lot of them are incredible journalists and incredible writers, but they're not presenters. They're not performers. They don't have the theater spirit. And so it's nice being able to do a live recording for that reason, because it's like, fundamentally, when I was writing and performing scripts there, I was trying to make my coworkers laugh. And if other people on the internet liked it too, that's fine. But it wasn't for you. It was for my friends at Polygon. And I miss that. And the other thing is, you're going to mess up a lot. When you're recording a script in front of a group of people, you are going to mess up. It's inevitable. You're going to mix up acronyms. You're going to, not include the right titles or pronunciations of things. If there's somebody in the room with you, they'll just tell you, and then you can do it immediately, redo it. If you're on your own, you have to figure it out in post, and then you have to go back and re-record stuff, and that is obnoxious.
Video essays being a very popular format with many practitioners, I asked whether anyone else in the space was inspiring Jenna in her own work.
I mean, there's so many great creators out there that are doing such interesting things. I would say the thing that I see a lot that I most want to mimic is like more complex and interesting editing things, because I've always edited always edited my own videos, not exclusively. But when the rare occasion I see somebody else edit one of my scripts, and I see the ways in which they incorporate jokes in the edit, which is something I'm not usually thinking of. Usually when I get to the edit, I'm thinking of like, oh, what's the right B-roll to get my point across? And that's good and useful in its own way. But I'm always astounded by other people's ability to find the joke in the edit. So that's something I would love to do more of. I did a Hades 2 video recently, and I did a little bit higher lift in terms of like editing the visuals of that, because I was doing so many side-by-side comparisons, and you can do a lot of interesting stuff where it's like, here, I'm going to like meld these three clips into one clip to see how that does. And so that stuff like that is quite fun, but it takes time and effort, and I don't always have that to put forth to it.
But Jenna's own channel isn't the only place she's putting out new videos these days. She also has a series with the channel Second Wind, looking at what I've perceived to be sort of inflection points in gaming history.
That's incidental, yeah. They're more about gamer drama, but those always end up having waves. I mean, there's so many decades of gaming history now, and gamers are such a intense and reactionary group, to put it gently. And they will often latch on to really fascinating things. And it's one of those things where it's like, I do feel like mainstream culture kind of isolates gaming culture away from it in a way that they don't with like movie culture or TV show culture, which is like everybody's watching Sopranos and everybody is supposed to watch Sopranos or whatnot. But like the biggest game in the world, people who are not tuned in with games would not be like, oh, I should try that out to a large extent. I mean, that's less so with games that appeal for a younger demographic like Fortnite or Roblox or Minecraft. But I think there is still this divide in our culture between gamers and adults. But that doesn't mean that these cultures and these sorts of behaviors aren't worth looking at and talking about. And I think we see sort of the effect that they have on gaming culture and broader culture every day, even if we're not aware of it. So it's also just fun for me to go back in gaming history and be like, what's the deal? What's the deal with Puddlegate? Like, what is actually happening here? Because the things that we say are happening here are usually hugely reductive. So it's nice to actually get elbow deep in the drama and see, like, is this justified? Or was this crazy behavior? Let's look at it.
And in a lot of these videos, Jenna uses contemporary newspaper articles or other sources to get a sense of opinions on these games or events. I asked where she tends to go to find these sources.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to hate to hear this, but New York Times has the most robust and high-quality archive of their newspaper articles because they digitized everything a long time ago and made it extremely searchable. They not only digitized it, but they transcribed it all. So it has basically perfect search. Yeah, this is the thing, is like, it is like an incredible resource. So I have a subscription to them. And the other thing is Internet Archive. I've just finished a new Game Arcadia video that should be coming out in December, but might come out in January, in which basically every single source had to be pulled from Internet Archive because just none of them exist anymore. But thank God for Internet Archive, because they do exist there. So especially as we've seen in the last few years, so many news archives that are specific to video games being bought or sold or just genuinely wiped out. Like the G4 TV archives are gone. And like you have all of these really important archives of news that have been wiped out that are at least preserved in Internet Archive, if nowhere else. But that's the thing, is like, if you study enough history, you realize that there is the history at the moment and the history that we remember. And there are a lot of more interesting and smart people than me have talked about history and the fact that it is a created concept of the past. It is not the past itself. And the farther you get from that moment, the less accurate it is. So it's always worthwhile to go back to that moment in so much as you can, hopefully with a complete context of the historical era, and say like, oh, you know, was this vindicated? Is this a justified reaction? Is it remembered unfavorably in hindsight because of cultural forces? Or was it legit? And there's always a little bit of truth in everything, so.
This idea of history as a construction by the present and what its shape tells us about those constructing it is one Jenna talked about in her video on why we think our ancestors were stupid, which brought us to a particularly relevant topic about how a group that defined itself in opposition to thoughtless adoption of technology came to be defined in retrospect as thoughtless rejection of technology.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because we tell these stories. History is just stories that we tell ourselves about the past. And so you have to step back and say, okay, why is this a story that we continue to repeat about the past? I think one interesting concept, the concept of Luddites is really fascinating because historically that word has, for the last few decades in American culture, represented somebody who hates technology and resists it. But historically, in the actual time period in which it existed, it was a bunch of people destroying looms because they were dangerous. And basically, it was, this is going to sound really familiar, it was a bunch of skilled labor being fired for a new technology, but that new technology is being used by people who are unskilled. And it was quite dangerous, and people were getting hurt because they didn't know how to operate these things. A lot of traditional labor was being sort of tossed aside for this shiny new machine. But over time, the concept of a Luddite became, in our culture, a shorthand for somebody who hates technology, who destroys technology, who resists getting email, and those sorts of things. But then, in just the last few years, it has once again been revised. People went back to the actual history of it and said, oh, maybe they had a point. Maybe technology is something that has been continually used to force out skilled labor in order to pay people less and put them in worse conditions. Because if you have skilled labor, then you have to pay people and you have to respect them, essentially. If you need their labor because you respect them, you have to pay them a certain amount. So how do we basically rewrite the rules of production to need less skilled labor? And that's something you see over and over and over again in our culture, and which we're going through right now with AI, and which we'll go through in the future with some other nonsense. But it's fascinating to have these sorts of revisions, because it's like, even the fact that we are revising it culturally means that our understanding of technology culturally is changing. So it's not just about the revising of the history, it's about why are we revising history.
Thinking about labor and advancement in video games led me to think about a discussion that had been happening last year about the price of indie games. Silksong, which is such a big game for such a reasonable price, engendered some amount of sentiment that it shouldn't be that cheap, because that sets a bad precedent for other indie games and what people can expect for them from a given cost. But of course, Team Cherry can price Silksong at $20 because they know it will sell really well, so they can get an even greater volume of sales by pricing it so reasonably.
Yeah, there's quite some interesting video game economists out there who crunch the numbers, because this is a huge question in the last few years for AAA games, which is, AAA games have been $60 for forever. And sort of part of why that's been possible is that the number of people who buy video games has increased. But there is a certain point at which there is so much saturation in the market that you can no longer justify selling something for $60, even though you will make a huge amount of profit. And there, this is a struggle, right? Because it's like, well, if you're still making, you know, $80 million in profit, meaning all of your game costs have already been covered, and you're making like an insane profit, like, do you really need to make your game $80? And the answer is, can we? Can we make our game $80? And so there's quite some complicated math about, like, okay, if you increase your game from $60 to $70, you're going to lose this percentage of the market, and this is how much you'll make in that new cost, and this is how much you'll lose. So is it worth it? And somebody sat down and crunched the numbers and found that, like, it's probably not worth it to raise it to $70, but it is probably worth it to raise it to $80.
Let the record show I made a sound of revulsion here.
So, because there are people who will drop out if mainstream video games become $61, there's a certain amount of the population who will stop buying it. And so that population will drop out, whether it's $61, $70, or $80. And so you have like this middle ground of people who will still be willing to pay no matter how much they increase. And so you've started to see the effect of that, where it's like, there's not a lot of games that are $80 now, but there are a lot of special editions or extended editions of games that are $80 and include like the soundtrack or include an art book. So there is that creep happening. And I think Team Cherry made the right choice selling their game for $20. I think that was the right choice for their company. I don't think most indie games should do that. I think most indie games should probably be pricing it around $30, unless you're genuinely concerned about backlash about the length of your game. They should probably be charging more.
Because if you don't respect your own labor when you can, you give lots of other people more opportunities to disrespect your labor. Back on the making and posting of video essays, Jenna's work tends to focus on games or movies that she thinks are good and wanting to explore or celebrate those things. But I've heard it said many times that YouTube and other platforms reward and incentivize negativity. What is it like trying to put positive energy into a platform like that?
I think it's something that people are now quite aware of, is like rage bait. And it's true, if you spend any amount of time on TikTok, it's just people dunking on each other endlessly. And it really drives me quite crazy. And it's one of those things where it's like, if you make content online, there are shortcuts you can take to be more successful. And I think what we're seeing now is the extent to which people are willing to take those in the form of AI. AI is just the most technology advanced form of these shortcuts, but these shortcuts exist all the time. I remember a few years ago talking to somebody who we were talking about me freelancing for them. I cannot remember who it was or if that happened, but we were talking about like exploitative thumbnails, basically like thumbnails that you see on YouTube that just are a close-up of a woman's chest in a video game. And I'm like, I don't want to be a part of an organization that behaves that way, because like, yeah, it probably does get more clicks. Yeah, you probably do get more clicks if you are willing to farm out women's bodies that way. But it's like, I don't want to be a part of that. And like, that's fundamentally the case, is like, if you make content for online, there are lots of shortcuts you can take. You can just, you know, I dunk on a pop. You can make a game about Hades 2 and why you think it sucks. You can make a Cinema Sins movie where you're like, oh, look at this. There's a cup and it's turned the wrong way in this scene than it was in this scene. And it's like, if all you want to do is make content, you can just do it. And it can be the worst content in the world. And people will watch it and you'll get paid and you can do what you want. But I take more of a, this is going to be such an insanely bold thing to say about my work that I'm not at all justified saying. I take more of a Jackie Chan approach to it, which is Jackie Chan has talked about a lot about how, you know, one shot in his movies might take 100 takes, but that's the work that has to get done to make something that he is proud of and happy to represent. And we watch Jackie Chan movies still. And we will continue as a culture to watch Jackie Chan movies probably for 100, 200, maybe the rest of humanity, because they're exceptional. They're incredible. And it's like, I'm not making stuff that's that intense, but I want to be able to stand by my work and say, I feel proud of what I have done here. I respect the things that I'm doing and I respect myself. And so you have to be able to look at yourself in the mirror in the morning. And I think a lot of people are just like, nope, I'll just use AI to make everything. It's fine. And it's like, that's fine. That's who you want to be. That's fine. But I don't want to make content that way. And I don't want to make content for people who are fine with that. I think it's a truism amongst content creators that the energy that you put out is the energy you're going to get back in your audience. And that's true to a certain extent. There's a ramping up point of fame where you become so broadly famous that your audience is so outside of your control. And that's inevitable. But I think if you're out here doing Mr. Beast type pranks, then you're going to get an audience that likes Mr. Beast style pranks. And that is simply not what I want for my life. I want to invite people in who like things and who like to think deeply about things. And I'm very happy and proud of and grateful for people who like my content because of that.
One of Jenna's videos that I think epitomizes this kind of ethos is one she made about Netflix's live-action Cowboy Bebop show. In that video, she offers a generally negative opinion of the show, but frames and thumbnails and titles the video around there actually being two good episodes, so still centering a positivity and willingness to engage with the text. In talking about how Cowboy Bebop functions, or doesn't, as a remake or reimagining, something in conversation with a source text, she said something that really reframed my view on what remakes or reimaginings of extant stories can be. As she says in the video, they allow new creators to change aspects that feel outdated or broken, while preserving ideas that still feel relevant. It's the malleability of oral tradition, but in a way that's acceptable for a culture that overly privileges recorded texts.
Yeah, that is a prime example of a video that I was like, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't do this. But I couldn't stop thinking about Cowboy Bebop, and I just wanted to exercise all of my thoughts about it. I'm glad I said something smart in it. it's true. I often speak to people who desperately want to record, who want to preserve. They want to preserve something in their lives. I was talking to a friend last New Year's. They are part of a Taiko group. And they really want to record all of their shows and they want to record practices so that they have like a document that exists for what that taiko drum sequence is at that moment so that they have this as a training tool. And I'm like, that in a way that makes sense, right? Like you want to preserve these things for future generations because the people who run that group won't always run that group. But on the other hand, it's like, well, but this is music. Every single instance of playing this is a different instance of playing this. So how do you ever record like the true instance of playing that? And I think that's true for anything that's a live performance. Like how do you record the definitive edition of a Shakespeare play? Well, you can't. You can only record an edition. But then those become their own like unique texts. And those unique texts can sort of warp anything that comes after it. Any time that you record something in amber, it, because of the nature of our society, becomes more valuable than the ephemeral live version. And that's worthwhile in some ways, but in some ways is a real drag on that. But inevitably, things change and the things that we want from stories change. And I mean, this is looping this back to Hades too, right? Like Odysseus in the original Odyssey is he does some messed up stuff. Like, he is a hero. It's undeniable he's a hero, but he does some things that from a modern perspective, we would consider pretty messed up. I'm always fascinated by the adaptations of his work or of the Odyssey because they so carefully excise certain things depending on the time period in which they are made, because our values change and the things that we consider heroic in a hero change. And so it's always fascinating to look at, I mean, there's a whole field of study of this called comparative literature, where they're comparing literature as remakes or comparing literature in different time periods. But I think it's fascinating to see like, oh, okay, what can we do to make Medea still Medea the character, but have some value in her that is different from how she has been treated before? How do we do that with Circe? How do we do that with Odysseus? I think a lot about there, I was thinking about this earlier today, because this is who I am as a person, but there's a really, the most famous ever radio show back when radio dramas were the height of culture was Sorry, Wrong Number. And we don't really talk about it anymore. It's just like not a piece of our modern pop culture in the way that some other radio dramas have stuck around. But this was a live show and had to be done hourly because of the different time zones. So it was performed by Agnes Moorehead. And the first of the five performances in the night that she had to do of Sorry, Wrong Number that went out on the radio broadcast, the final line of it is somebody picks up a receiver, says, sorry, wrong number, and hangs up. And that's like the punchline to the title. The first version of this that went out, he flubs it. He flubs the line, which is the line of the story. And he just says it wrong. But then he gets it right every other time. And I think a lot about like, there was enough right versions and we have the script of it and we have all these recordings of it that we know what the right way to do it was. But there's a twist of fate in which we only have that one recording and we're just like, why is this story called Sorry, Wrong Number when it should have been sorry, she's not here or whatever he says. It's just fascinating. I don't know. We privilege written and recorded texts too much. That's what I'll say. I mean, everything's unpredictable. You can edit things and have some amount of control over it, but isn't it better to just succumb? Isn't it better to just succumb to the chaos of aliveness and the faultiness of memory and the beautiful idea that these existences live within us and our memories and our experiences and can never be retrieved again? Isn't there something valuable and worthwhile about that?
The irony that we rounded out our now half-lost conversation by weighing the virtues of recorded versus ephemeral experiences, and that I'm trying to reconstruct some facsimile of it now, is not lost on me. And it is a cool and special thing that only I got to experience this conversation, but it still felt important to share what parts of it I could with you all listening. A huge thanks to Jenna for talking to me, particularly how much we talked about my favorite games of 2025, and her patience as we put this episode together in this form. If you want to know where she landed on her best of 2025, her Game of the Year video is up now on her YouTube channel, Jenna Stieber, along with lots of other fun and thoughtful things to watch.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for, you had so many thoughtful and interesting questions. Thank you so much.
And thank you all for listening to this unusual episode of The Spark. As always, this show is brought to you because of the Nashville Public Library. So, whether you're listening in Nashville or beyond, find your local library, get a library card, and use it. Because the best way to support your public library is to let it support you with all the goods and services they offer. I bet there's more than you think. See you next time.